geocentric orbit, which might have happened accidentally or as the planned result of a controlled burn. Assuming it was following its original plan, Ymir should then have made almost two full loops around the Sun, since its orbit was well inside of Earth's. The perihelion was halfway between the orbits of Venus and Mercury. It would have done this in just a little more than a year, grazing the orbit of Greg's skeleton, Comet Grigg-Skellerup, a couple of hundred days ago. But this would have occurred when it was on the far side of the Sun from the Earth, making it difficult to observe. The next event would have been a small matter of impregnating the comet's core, or a piece of it, with an exposed nuclear reactor on the end of a stick, and then turning it on to generate thrust by blowing a plume of steam out the entry hole. They would have done a large burn, pulling out the reactor's control blades, powering it up, and releasing a plume of steam that would have altered the comet's trajectory by about 1 kilometer per second, enough to put it on a collision course with Earth, or at least with L1, a couple of hundred days later. The timing was awkward, and many had griped about it, wondering why Sean hadn't gone after some other comet, or plotted some other course that might have brought it home a little sooner. But people who knew their way around the solar system understood that it was near miraculous good fortune for any comet core to be in a position to be grappled and moved in such a short span of time. The hasty shake-and-bake nature of the Ymir expedition, which had stirred up so much controversy, had been forced by the implacable timeline of celestial mechanics. Time, tide, and comets waited for no man. And even if it had been possible to bring a comet back sooner, it would have been reckless and politically impossible. What if the calculations were wrong and the comet slammed into the Earth? So, the plan of the Ymir expedition was the only one that could have worked. If indeed it were working at all. And since much of the action, the rendezvous with the comet, and the burn of the nuke-powered steam-fueled engine, had occurred while it was on the far side of the Sun. This had been very much in doubt until a couple of months ago, when astronomical observations had proved conclusively that Comet Grigg-Skellerup had changed its course, something that could only have happened as the result of human intervention. The comet was headed right for them. It would have triggered mass panic on Earth had Earth not already been doomed. Since then, they had watched its orbit converging slowly with that of Earth and plotted the time when it would disappear against the Sun once more as it reached L1. The reactor would then have to be powered up again, as a huge burn would be needed to synchronize Ymir's orbit with Earth's and pilot it through L1 to a long ellipse that would bring it their way. "I think about them every day," Dinah answered.
"When are they supposed to hit L1?
"Any time, but it's going to be a long burn. They might sort of grease it in over a period of a few days rather than trying to do one sharp impulse."
"Makes sense,"
Dube said.
"One high-G maneuver might cause the ice to break apart. When was the last time they communicated?"
"On the X-band? The real radio?" "A few weeks after they left. Almost 2 years ago, but clearly they're still alive, so it must have been radio failure."
"Well, let's go with that theory,"
Dube suggested.
"Jury-rigging a new radio that would transmit over such a distance would be kind of hopeless. The best they could hope for would be to cook something up that might work when they got closer, and to settle for lower bandwidth."
"My dad used to talk about spark gap transmitters," Dinah said. "It was a technology they used..."
"Back before transistors and vacuum tubes, yes,"
Dube said. Dinah telegraphed down. "Does QET sound like an old-time Sparky to you?" Rufus returned.
"Yes, come to think of it."
"They took some of my robots with them," Dinah said. "All they would have to do is jot down the MAC addresses on those units' interface boards, and they'd have a sort of crude proof of identity. As a matter of fact,
and she began to pull up some of the records she had made almost 2 years ago of the robots and part numbers issued to Sean and his crew. Within a few minutes, she was able to verify that the MAC address that had come in via Morse code a few minutes ago matched one on a robot that had been taken to Ymir.
Who has access to the file you just consulted?
Dube asked, still in devil's advocate mode. Are you kidding? You know how Sean is with the encryption and everything. All of this stuff is locked down. I mean, I'm sure the NSA could get in, but not some random prankster.
Just checking,
Dube said.
It seems awfully roundabout is all I'm saying. Why doesn't he just broadcast something like, Hey, Dinah, it's me, Sean, my radio's busted. That would seem easier.
You have to know Sean, Dinah said. Look, anything he sends out over that channel is getting broadcast to basically the entire Earth. It's going to go up on the Internet. Everyone's going to know his business. He has no idea what the situation is. There's no Internet up there, and his radio's been out for a long time. He doesn't even know if anyone is alive up here, or if there's been a military coup or something. He doesn't want to come back here if we've turned into the Klingon Empire.
I think you're right,
Dube said.
He's going to ease into it. Test the waters.
45 minutes later, Dinah was taking down a new message from QET. It started with RTFM-5, then the number 00001, and went on as an apparently meaningless series of random letters. The only part I understand is read the fucking manual, Dinah said, followed by the number 5.
Did he bring any manuals up with him?
He brought a bunch of stuff, Dinah said, from the engineers in Seattle, and left some of it here.
You have a faraway look in your eye, Dinah.
I remember asking him, why did you print that stuff out? Why not use thumb drives like everyone else? And he said, owning your own space company brings some perks, Dinah said. She found them after a few minutes rummaging in storage bins. Half a dozen three-ring binders, volumes 1 through 6, of the Arjuna Expedition's employee manual. The entire stack was a foot thick. Dube whistled.
Given the cost per pound of launching stuff into space, this is probably worth more than the Gutenberg Bible that showed up last week.
They went straight to Volume 5, which, for the most part, looked like any other corporate employee manual. But in between the sexual harassment policy and the dress code was a half-inch-thick stack of pages with no readable content at all. Random sequences of capital letters had been printed all over them, in groups of 5, column after column, row after row, all the way down each page. Each of these pages had a different number at its top, beginning with 00001. "This is the Boy Adventure secret code shit that Lars always used," Dinah said. "But I'll be damned if I know..."
"I'm embarrassed to say that I know exactly what this is,"
Dube said.
"These are one-time pads. It's the simplest code there is, but the most difficult to break, if you do it right. But you have to have this."
And he rattled page 00001 in his hand. Once Dube had explained how it worked, Dinah was able to begin decrypting the message by hand, but in a few minutes, Dube had written a Python script that made it easy to finish the job.
"I came here thinking I was going to have a drink and chat about asteroid mining,"
he said. "Oh, stop grumbling. This is way more interesting," Dinah said. The message read, "Two alive, thrusting at full power, send sitrep."
"There were 6 in the original crew, right?"
Dube asked. "Something must have happened," Dinah said. "Maybe they hit a rock or something, damaged the antenna, lost some people. Maybe the radiation got to them."
"Well, it sounds like they are coming back,"
Dube said. "Yeah, unless..."
"Unless what?"
"Unless he just wants to hang out at L1. That would be a hell of a lot safer. I don't think any moon shards are going to make it out that far." Dube reread the message.
"You're right,"
he said.
All he says is that they're thrusting. Nothing about transferring back to low Earth orbit. Then he asks for a situation report.
He put his hands over his face and rubbed it.
I'm fading,
he announced.
I should be Skyping my family right now.
Get out of here, Dinah said. I can work on the report, and I can encrypt it now that you showed me how it works. Dube pushed off and drifted to the exit, then caught himself and turned back.
I could figure this out myself, he said, but it's late. Maybe you know off the top of your head. If Sean goes into that transfer orbit from L1 to here, how long before he shows up?
37 days, Dinah said.
About 17 days into the hard rain,
Dube said.
Awkward timing.
Dinah looked back at him. She didn't say a word, but he knew what she was thinking. If only awkward timing were the worst of our problems.
Okay,
Dube said.
Thanks, Dinah.
Next time, she said, and made a drinky-drinky motion with her thumb and pinky.
Next time,
he agreed, and pushed through the curtain. Dinah checked the time. Now that she knew roughly where Ymir was, she understood the timing of the transmissions. During a certain part of each 93-minute orbit, Izzy was on the wrong side of the Earth and couldn't receive Sean's signal. Following each blackout period was a window during which they could talk. They had just burned a window, taking down his transmission and decrypting it, and were about to go into blackout again. During that span of time, Dinah should be able to write a short message and get it encrypted using the next one-time pad. What to write wasn't entirely clear. She could provide some obvious data, like the number of arclets currently in orbit, the number of people, how many robots she had up and running, but she suspected that Sean wanted a different kind of information. He wanted to know what would happen were he to show up 37 days from now with a mountain of ice. The Cloud Ark could use it, that was for sure. Likewise, Sean needed the Cloud Ark. Two guys on a spaceship pushing a giant ball of ice was not a sustainable civilization. But Sean was going to be cagey. He was going to want something. He would want to make a deal. He would want to make a deal with Dinah's boyfriend. One step at a time. Just sending him a few basic stats would occupy the next transmission window. Rather than driving herself crazy worrying about the longer game, Dinah focused on that through the next blackout period, writing up a message as tersely as possible and then encrypting it using Dube's Python script. The L1 point of the Earth-Sun system was located on a straight line between those two bodies. Ymir, for all practical purposes, was at L1. So generally speaking, when Izzy swung around the dark side of the Earth and emerged into the sunlight, it meant that they could see L1 and communicate with Ymir. This next occurred at about 7:30 a.m. Greenwich time, which happened to be sunrise in London. Dinah, gazing down out her little window, was able to see the Terminator, the dividing line between the day and night sides of Earth, creeping over the Thames estuary down below, and lighting up a few tall spires in the London Financial District. Then she turned to her telegraph key, established contact with Ymir, and tapped out her message. This ended up consuming the entire transmission window. She had to send the characters very slowly, because Sean wasn't very good at reading Morse code, and because the message was encrypted, he wasn't able to guess missing letters from context, and so every letter had to be read clearly. By the time she was finished, Izzy had swung almost halfway around the world and was about to plunge back into night. She finished her transmission with TBC, which she hoped they would understand as to be continued, then went right back to work writing and encrypting a supplement. She was getting ready to open another broadcast window a little before 9 a.m. London time, or .9 in Izzy speak, when Ivy floated in without knocking. I want to look out your window, she announced.
That's fine, Dinah said. What's up?
Because obviously something was up. Ivy's face looked funny, and she had said, "Your window," not "your window."
"What's so special about my window?" Dinah asked.
"It's next to you,"
Ivy said. "Is everything okay?" Dinah asked, because clearly everything wasn't. Her first thought was that the Morse code transmissions had been intercepted and that Dinah was in trouble. But if that were the case, Ivy would not be in here asking to look out her window. She looked at her friend. Ivy went immediately to the window and then positioned herself to look down at the earth. By now, the Terminator had advanced to the point where it had lit up the easternmost bulge of South America. Izzy was about to cross the equator, which was almost directly below them.
"I heard from Cal," Ivy said.
She said it without the usual note of pleasure in her voice.
"That's good. I thought his boat was underwater."
"It was until a couple of hours ago."
"They popped up?"
"They popped up."
"Where?"
"Down there," Ivy said.
"How do you know?" Dinah asked. "Surely he's not beaming you his coordinates."
"I can tell," Ivy said, "by putting two and two together."
"What did he say?"
"He said to prepare for some launches out of Kourou."
"They're going to reopen the spaceport?"
Ivy gasped. Dinah glided over and got right behind Ivy, hugging her and hooking her chin over Ivy's shoulder so that she could share the same viewing angle. They knew where Kourou was. They looked at it all the time, and sometimes even saw the bright plumes of rocket engines on the launch pads. What Ivy had reacted to was a little different. Sparks of light were appearing along the coast, spreading and fading. A barrage of them, peppered across the interval between the beach and Devil's Island.
"What the hell are those?" Dinah asked. "Are those nukes?"
"I don't know," Ivy said.
Then Dinah's question was answered by a much brighter light that flared along the coast to the northwest, fading slightly to a luminescent ball that tumbled upward toward space.
"I think that was a nuke," Ivy said.
"We just nuked Venezuela?"
It took a few moments for their eyes to adjust. That was just as well, since their minds had to do some adjusting as well. Once the light had faded, they could see that the mushroom cloud was actually offshore of the Venezuelan landmass, a few miles out to sea.
"A demonstration shot. Visible from Caracas?" Dinah asked.
"Partly that," Ivy said. "But yesterday they were saying that the whole Venezuelan Navy was headed for Kourou to restore order. I'll bet that Navy no longer exists."
"The smaller fireballs, near the spaceport?"
"I'm going to guess fuel-air explosives. They would do almost as much damage as tactical nukes without contaminating the launch site."
Ivy had shrugged loose from Dinah's embrace and turned around so that her back was to the window. They were now hovering close to each other. Dinah finally got it.
"You said that Cal's boat had popped up, that it was on the surface, that he knew something. You think..."
"I know," Ivy mouthed.
Cal had received the order, direct from JBF, and he had launched the nuke. He'd probably launched cruise missiles with fuel-air devices as well. People assumed that Ivy and Dinah had grown apart in the last year, but then people had assumed that they were at odds to begin with. There was no point in trying to keep track of what people imagined. Ivy's loss of her position to Dinah's boyfriend hadn't made matters any simpler. But things had never been bad between them, just complicated. Ivy was pretty articulate, but there wasn't a lot about the current situation that could be talked through. After a few minutes, though, she found a way.
"I guess what sucks is that all I'm going to have of him is memories," Ivy said. "And I was trying to cultivate some good ones to carry with me."
She wasn't exactly crying, but her voice had gone velvety.
"You know he had no choice," Dinah said.
The chain of command is still in effect.
Of course I understand that, Ivy said. Still, it's just not what I wanted.
We knew it was going to get ugly, Dinah said.
Her radio started beeping.
Speaking of which...
Who the hell is that? Ivy asked.
Sean Probst, Dinah said. He's back.
Ivy hung out in Dinah's shop for a while, as Dinah laboriously keyed out the second half of her situation report. By the time South America had passed from view, long trails of black smoke were streaking northeast from the burning wreckage of the People's Justice Blockade and casting shadows on the wrinkled skin of the Atlantic. Bright sparks had appeared over Kourou again, but now they were the incandescent plumes of solid boosters chucking heavy-lift vehicles into the sky.
Back in business, Ivy said. I guess I better revise those spreadsheets.
You think Cal is still on the surface? Still reachable?
I doubt it,
Ivy said, in a tone of voice that suggested she wouldn't know what to say to him.
I don't think it's standard practice to launch a nuclear missile and then just hang out.
Certain aspects of Cloud Arc culture were more objectionable than others to Dr. Moira Crewe. She just didn't think it was decent to live in a place where there were no coffee shops to have breakfast in when she woke up, and no public houses in which to socialize at day's end. This was partly the result of overcrowding, partly because people lived on three different shifts, so there was no unanimity as to when morning and evening fell, and partly because the place had been hastily designed by American and Russian engineers who were blind to the importance of such things. She'd had a number of good chats about it with Louisa, who understood, and they had formed a sort of vague resolution to do something about it once the hard rain had begun and the Cloud Arc had settled into some kind of long-term routine. Moira's dream was to be the proprietor of an establishment, perhaps constructed in a single arclet, that would serve that purpose. But she had not yet worked out how to get the timing just right. Of course, she knew that she had much more important duties, the responsibility of perpetuating the human race, and most other species, was largely on her shoulders. It wouldn't do for her to spend hours every day pulling espresso shots and wiping down counters. They didn't even have the capability yet of growing coffee or barley in space, so the supply of consumables was going to run out pretty damn soon, and her pub would end up serving Tang. But it was a dream. And in the meantime, she could use the coffee room adjacent to the farm as a sort of R&D laboratory. Arising each day at Dot 8, she would make her way back to H2, descend a spoke to the T3 Taurus, make herself a cup of the reprehensible freeze-dried coffee and a little bowl of equally bad freeze-dried oatmeal, and then go to a little conference table in the middle of the farm and have a sit. As often as not, she would be joined by other sleepy-eyed third shifters. Marcus Luker was one of them, and generally too busy to just sit and drink coffee with people, but he would make time for her occasionally. Conrad Barth sometimes joined her, as did Reese Aitken. And from time to time, Tekla would show up. Of these, Tekla was the most curious and interesting case on more than one level. To put it bluntly, she was of a different social caste. Moira, Dube, Conrad, Reese, and many of the other members of the general population were the sorts of people who might once have encountered each other at TED or Davos, or appeared together on panels at think tanks. Not Tekla. Her curious career as one of the rare female members of the Russian military, an Olympic athlete, a test pilot, and a cosmonaut certainly made her interesting enough to be invited to a TED-like conference. But her lack of fluency in English and a certain degree of social awkwardness would have ruled her out as a presenter. The lacerations she had suffered during her escape from the crippled Luke had been sewn up by amateurs. On Earth, she'd have gone straight into the care of a plastic surgeon. But on Izzy, she'd just accepted the results. Moira wished she spoke better Russian so that she could talk to Tekla about her ideas regarding appearance and grooming. The facial scars put her well outside the norms of feminine beauty, and she had doubled down by electing to keep the buzz cut. In spite of this, or perhaps because of it, she was, to put it bluntly, kind of hot. Moira hated to say it. But hotness was a part of the human condition, and it was pointless to pretend that it did not exist. Moira herself was largely heterosexual. When younger, she had slept with two different women, one in the English Cambridge and one in the Massachusetts Cambridge. This had been perfectly all right, and she in no way regretted it, but it had required an awful lot of thinking. Way too much cerebration about gender and queer theory had preceded and succeeded those brief moments of passion, and those relationships had faded from her life. It had occurred to her, in spite of efforts to keep such thoughts at bay, that Tekla would be an altogether different style of partner, and she had to admit that she found this pretty interesting. There was an entire story about Tekla's sexuality that had begun a few weeks after her rescue with some kind of elaborate soap opera. A love triangle or quadrangle involving both men and women, loosely enshrined in the oral history of Izzy, but not something Moira had ever cared to learn more about. The gist of it was that after a few months, Tekla had begun openly sleeping with other women, eliciting vast amounts of analysis and commentary and drama. The analysis had tended to come from gender theorists talking about the somewhat uncomfortable fact that Tekla was an athlete who had looked kind of butch even when she had been glammed up for the Olympics, and looked a hell of a lot more so now. Her coming out, though she had never formally done so, thus tended to reinforce existing stereotypes about female athletes. The commentary came from millions of idiots on the internet. And the drama occurred in Tekla's relationships with the other Russians, who constituted a powerful bloc on the space station. This had faded as they'd gotten used to it, as more people of various nationalities and sexualities had joined the Cloud Ark, and as everyone had focused their attentions on larger problems. But it had turned Tekla into a curious, solitary creature, socially distant from the only people with whom she could carry on a fluent conversation. The expectation among politically correct academic leftist observers had been that she would undergo a personal transformation and become like an academic leftist. But she seemed to have retained the same basic attitude about order and discipline that had made her a scout in the first place, and that had led her to putting Sean Probst in an arm lock and offering to choke him out. Sitting across the table from her, drinking her coffee and picking at her oatmeal, Moira idly wondered whether Tekla was aware of the fact that there was a whole genre of internet fan pornography devoted to imaginary couplings, more or less sadomasochistic, between her and Sean Probst. In any case, Tekla's tendency to occasionally sit with Moira during breakfast seemed like, if not a direct invitation, then at least a preliminary gambit. Preoccupied with such thoughts, Moira was oblivious at first to the fact that the farm was suddenly crowded with people looking at the big situational awareness monitor above the end of the table where she and Tekla were having their breakfast. The viewing angle was awkward, and so she had to change her position to get a good look. It was a news channel showing scraps of cell phone video that had been spliced together to approximate a story. At the beginning of the story, the People's Justice Blockade was riding at anchor in the waters between the beach and Devil's Island, just beginning to catch the pink light of dawn. At the end of the story, the sun was shining on the churned slurry of crushed hulls and floating corpses visible through gaps between dreadlocks of smoke. In the middle were glimpses of black motes droning in from the sea and fantastic bubbles of flame spreading to envelop vast areas before they burst and disappeared, leaving behind wreckage that looked like it had been beaten with sledgehammers and doused with napalm. From there, the video would loop to sterile three-dimensional renderings of missile submarines and cruise missiles, and footage of the White House briefing room, where the president had made a short statement before turning matters over to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Other world leaders were chiming in from Downing Street, the Kremlin, Berlin, all of which was pretty compelling in and of itself, until, just at the moment when Moira was going to look away to her oatmeal, something bright caught her eye on the screen, and she looked back to see video of a mushroom cloud rising over an ocean. "Did I miss something?" Moira asked. "That didn't look like a meteorite strike."
"Nuke," Tekla said.
Moira looked at her. Tekla's gaze, which some found chilly, was fixed on Moira's face. Moira didn't find it chilly at all. Tekla, for once, glanced away shyly.
"Venezuela," she added. "Navy is no longer a problem. Rockets are launched again."
She shrugged. She was wearing a tank top. Moira couldn't stop looking at her deltoids. She had to stop doing that.
"On the beach, it was fuel air bombs," Tekla continued. "Extremely destructive."
Tekla leaned back in her chair and draped an arm casually over the back of the empty chair next to her.
"What is your opinion, Dr. Crew?"
"Please, call me Moira."
"Sorry. Russian formality."
Tekla was, maybe, cagier than she looked. She anticipated that someone like Dr. Crew would be horrified by the fact that we were now nuking people. She wanted to get it out in the open right away, while it was still fresh. Lost in contemplation of the structure of Tekla's arm, Moira was startled when a large, strongly built man slammed down into the chair next to her. She looked over to see that it was Marcus Luker. He placed a cup of coffee on the table in front of him and contemplated it for a moment, almost pointedly not looking at the video screens with their infinite, multi-angled replays of mushroom clouds and briefing rooms. Then he turned and looked at Moira, greeting her with raised eyebrows and a nod, and then giving Tekla the same treatment. So Moira was absolved from having to answer Tekla's question. Marcus answered it, even though no one had asked him.
"I know that I am at somewhat of a disadvantage here because I am a speaker of German, and so there is certain baggage. So, yes, the baggage is acknowledged. I see the awkwardness of it. The delicacy. But..."
"Did you know it was going to happen?" Moira asked him.
"No. It comes as a complete surprise to me."
Moira nodded.
"But had they asked for my opinion, I would have said yes," Marcus said.
"They are all going to die anyway,"
Tekla said, nodding. It struck Moira, just then, that Marcus and Tekla were quite comfortable with each other. It made sense. Marcus would not be the least bit troubled by Tekla's sexuality. On the contrary, it would make things much simpler for a man like him if he knew she were unavailable. He was an ex-military pilot. So was she. Naturally, they would tend to view certain things in the same way. For a while, during the Cloud Ark's first year, Tekla had been a sort of itinerant laborer. It might seem strange that a space station could support a person with no particular job, but none of the scouts had really been expected to survive. So none of them had been sent up with long-term roles in mind. Her alienation from the Russians who took the brunt of the spacewalking work had led her to try her hand at a number of different tasks. She knew the interior of Izzy as well as anyone, but she also knew how to operate the controls of an arklet, and she could put on a spacesuit and go out and weld things in space. Her period of wandering in the wilderness seemed to have ended when Marcus had taken over. Moira was no longer precisely certain what it was that Tekla did for a living, but she now had the clear sense that Tekla was working for Marcus directly, that he was trusting her to do something. "They're all going to die, yes," said another voice, "but we're not." It was Louisa. She came up behind Tekla and wordlessly asked permission to use the chair on which the Russian had draped her arm. Tekla not only gave it, but rose to her feet and pulled the chair out as a courtesy. "We're not all going to die, or at least that's what I'm hoping," Louisa went on. "And we have all just seen this happen. It's in our memories now,
And not just that, but in a few hours we'll be taking deliveries from Kourou, reaping the benefits of having used fuel-air explosives and nuclear weapons against people who were basically defenseless. It's in our DNA now. Her eyes flicked toward Moira. If you'll pardon the poetic imagery, Dr. Crewe. Moira gave her a little smile and nodded. Marcus said,
"So, do you disagree with it?"
"No," Louisa said. "Let's be clear, Marcus. I have baggage, too. I'm a brown Spanish speaker from South America. I devoted years of my life to hanging out with refugees on boats. And I'm a Jew. That's my baggage, okay?"
"Understood,"
Marcus said. "I'm not down there. I don't know what advice JBF was getting, what she knew that we don't."
"So, what is your point?"
Marcus asked, crisply but politely. "We have no laws, no rights, no constitution, no legal system, no police." Marcus and Tekla looked at each other across the table. It was not a sneaky look, or a guilty look, or a conniving look, but it was a significant look.
"It is being worked on,"
Marcus said. He wasn't kidding. Ever since the Crater Lake Accord had been signed, a whole think tank full of constitutional scholars had been toiling away on it in The Hague, and one of them was now resident up here. "I know it is," Louisa answered, "and it is very important to me that atrocities such as what we're seeing on these screens don't somehow infect that process. This cannot be business as usual." Marcus and Tekla, still looking at each other, seemed to arrive at a mutual decision to say nothing. Moira's phone vibrated. Looking at its screen, she saw that she had an appointment in 15 minutes. She excused herself from what had become a very strange coffee clutch. Oh well, perhaps it had cured her of some sentimental ideas. She had walked in aspiring to somehow recreate the experience of breakfasting in a sidewalk cafe in Europe, and instead been treated to half an hour of nuclear warfare, mass incineration of protesters, and serious ethical discourse mixed in with a suddenly keen sexual tension between her and Tekla. Like quite a few other people on the Cloud Ark, she hadn't had sex since she had come up here. Many, whose consciences were unencumbered by the existence of doomed spouses or fiancés on the ground, had figured out a way to make it happen. But many others were not getting any. This couldn't possibly last. A couple of docked capsules had been set aside for conjugal visits, and everyone knew of quiet places around the space station where you could do it. Moira didn't have anyone down on the ground. She had abstained for lack of anyone up here, and just because it was the least sexy place you could possibly imagine. But it was starting to get to her. One of the items on her long-term to-do list, actually, was to come up with a policy for how to handle pregnancy aboard the Cloud Ark. Since pregnant people weren't fundamentally that different from those who weren't, what that really boiled down to was how to handle babies. The assumption, made by the architects, was that this was going to be an orderly process, and that anyone who got pregnant would do so with the intent of having the embryo frozen so that it could be implanted later, when conditions were better for raising little ones. Having now spent the better part of a year up here, Moira doubted this. The architects were, she felt, underestimating the cultural difference between the general population and the Arkies. Until a few months ago, they had been referred to as Arkers, and in all official communications still were. Then someone had coined the term Arkies, and in one of those only-on-the-internet viral phenomena, it had swept across the planet in about 24 hours and become universal. A few sensitive Arkansas historians had registered objections, but they had been steamrolled. The Arkies were just kids, and they had surprisingly little exposure to the G-pop. The Arklets they lived in couldn't really change their positions in the swarm. Moving from one Arklet to the next was nearly impossible. It was an epic journey in a spacesuit, requiring some fancy tricks with orbital mechanics. Small utility spacecraft, called flivvers, were available to squire people around, but there were only so many of them, and qualified pilots were few. Marcus, following suggestions from Louisa, had tried to make up for this by stirring the pot, meaning that about 10% of the Arkies at any given time were living and working aboard Izzy. But most of the time, most of them were stranded in individual arcs or in triads or heptads, their only connection to the general population being through video conferencing, Skype, social media, Spacebook, and other tech that had been transplanted from the Earthbound world. Moira would be astonished if some girls weren't pregnant already, but no one had approached her about getting an embryo frozen. And any normal person who followed Moira forward through Zvezda and down into the cold storage facility would understand why. There was nothing about this place that tickled the nerve endings that mattered to people who wanted to start families. It was clinical industrial to a degree that was almost laughable. But by the same token, she hoped it would seem impressive to the new arrivals, who showed up right on time for their appointment. They had arrived several hours ago on a passenger capsule launched from Cape Canaveral, long enough for their anti-nausea meds to kick in and for them to pull themselves together a little bit. It was a small contingent from the Philippines. A scientist who had been working on genetically modified strains of rice, a sociologist who had been working with Filipino sailors who spent their whole lives on cargo freighters, she'd be working with Louisa, presumably, and a pair of Arkies who, judging from looks, were from ethnic groups as different as Icelanders were from Sicilians. One of them was carrying the inevitable beer cooler. As Moira knew perfectly well, for she did this at least once a day, it contained sperm, ova, and embryos collected from donors scattered around the country of origin, in this case, the Philippines. She accepted it with due ceremony, like a Japanese businessman taking another's business card, and flipped the lid open for inspection. A few chunks of dry ice were still visible on the bottom. Good. The finger-sized vials were all contained within a hexagonal cage. She sampled some of them with a pistol-shaped infrared thermometer and verified that none of them had thawed out. Then, after putting on some cotton gloves to protect her skin from the cold, she pulled a few out and spot-checked them just to verify that they had been sealed, labeled, and barcoded in accordance with the procedures specified in the third technical supplement to the Crater Lake Accord, Volume 3, Section 4, Paragraph 11. They had. She'd have expected nothing less from Dr. Miguel Andrada, the geneticist. She also guessed that Dr. Andrada suspected, at some level, that none of these samples had a snowball's chance in hell of ever developing into sentient life forms. But this was not a subject to talk about now. For the benefit of the others, Moira gave a little canned speech, trying to make it sound spontaneous, thanking them, and by extension, the people of the Philippines for having entrusted her and the Cloud Ark with these most precious contributions and hinting, without promising, at a future in which a cornucopia of vibrant humanity would spring forth from each little plastic vial. It was expected that these people would go forth now to their arklets and text or Facebook the news down to their friends and family at home. The promise in those words was meant to keep people on Earth from getting too rambunctious while they waited for the end. And if that failed, as it had in the case of Venezuela, well, JBF could just nuke them.
"May I see how it all works?"
Dr. Andrada asked, after the rest of his delegation had been sent on their way. So it was just the two of them now, hovering in a long, slim docking module it projected to the nadir side. Below them, its far end was sealed off by a hatch with a keypad. Most of Izzy was open to anyone who wanted to wander in and poke around. They didn't get a lot of riffraff. But the HGA, the Human Genetic Archive, had a kind of quasi-sacred status and was kept under the digital equivalent of lock and key. Dr. Andrada was a small, wiry man with prominent cheekbones. Like some other ag geneticists Moira had known, he had a calloused, tanned, leathery look the result of spending a lot of time in experimental plots, digging in actual dirt. Except for a nice pair of eyeglasses, he could have passed for a farmer anywhere in Southeast Asia. But he had a PhD from UC Davis and had been on the fast track for a Nobel Prize before the agent had intervened. "Of course," Moira said. "I'd fancy a chat, anyway, about how we're going to grow things other than humans up here."
"We need to talk about that,"
Dr. Andrada agreed. She drifted down, performing a slow somersault so that she could address the keypad, and punched the button that turned on the iris scanner. After a few moments, the device agreed that she was Dr. Moira Crewe and unlocked the hatch. Bracing herself with a handle on the wall, she pulled it open, then allowed herself to drift through into the docking module beyond. There was barely room in this for both her and Dr. Andrada. White LEDs came on automatically. Clipped to the wall was a simple nylon web belt with a few small electronic gadgets holstered in it. Moira took this and buckled it around her waist. They had entered through the hatch on the module's zenith side. To port and starboard were openings that had been sealed off by round plastic shields. Each of these had a handle projecting from its center. The closest to Moira was the one on the port side, so she grabbed the handle, squeezed it to release a latch, and then pulled it out of the way. Dr. Andrada flinched at the frigid air that washed into the space in its wake. They were looking down a straight tube about 10 meters long, large enough for one person to work comfortably, or for two to pass each other if they didn't mind bumping bodies. Its walls were studded with long, neat rows of smaller hatches about as wide as a splayed human hand, each with its own little handle. Hundreds of them. Closer to the entrance, these bore neat, machine-printed labels and barcodes. Farther away, they were blank. Next to each one of them was a blue LED. These provided the space's only illumination. "Would you like to do the honors?" Moira said.
"If I don't freeze to death first,"
Dr. Andrada said.
"Space is cold," Moira said. "We rely on that."
She gave him a minute to put on the cotton gloves, then opened the cooler and held it out. He removed the little rack containing the samples. Moira zapped its barcode with a handheld scanner from her belt. Dr. Andrada pulled himself into the cold storage module and began to drift deeper into it, gingerly prodding the walls in a way that marked him out as a new arrival to zero gravity.
"Take the first one that's unlabeled," Moira said. "Leave the door open, please."
Dr. Andrada coughed as the chilly air made his throat spasm. He opened one of the small hatches and slid the sample rack into it. In the meantime, Moira was using a handheld printer to generate a sticker identifying the sample in English, in Filipino, and in a machine-readable barcode language. Once Dr. Andrada had returned to the central module, she went up to the open hatch, verified that the sample rack was properly seated in the tubular cavity beyond, then closed the hatch and affixed the sticker to its front. Printed on the hatch was a unique identification number and a barcode conveying the same thing, which she zapped and then double-checked. The LED next to this hatch had turned red, signaling that the compartment's temperature was too high. While Moira checked her work, it turned yellow, which suggested the cold was soaking in. Later, she'd pull it up on the screen of her tablet and verify that it had gone blue. She flew back out to the docking module and grabbed the round shield that sealed off the cold store.
"Now you know what these are for," she said. "Thermal insulation."
She snapped the shield back into place.
"I could open the other one," she offered, "but you would see the same thing."
"Thank you anyway," said Dr. Andrada, "but I have never been so cold in my life."
They went back up to Zvezda, and then proceeded forward to the complex of modules where most of the genetic engineering gear was stored. There was nothing to see here but boxes. They could just as easily have gone aft to one of the tori, but Moira knew from experience that new arrivals didn't benefit from switching back and forth between zero-G and simulated gravity. Through the nice eyeglasses, Dr. Andrada was giving Moira a look that she read as polite but skeptical. Fair enough. She decided to broach what was probably on his mind.
"Forgive me that bit of ceremony," she said. "I've done it once or twice a day for a year. I'm as much priestess as scientist. You're meant to blog it, of course. To tell the people down below that you personally hand-carried the samples all the way from Manila to a cold storage location on Izzy." "Yes, I understand that. I will do so."
He paused, signaling a change in topic.
"It is not exactly decentralized."
Moira nodded. "If that thing gets hit with a rock 10 minutes from now, all of the samples are destroyed."
"Yes, that is my concern."
"Mine as well. It all boils down to statistics and mathematics. For now, there aren't that many rocks, and we can see them and avoid them if necessary. Keeping all the eggs in one basket."
"And sperm,"
Dr. Andrada said, in what had become the oldest joke in Moira's personal universe, "is actually a safer bet, for the next couple of weeks, than trying to distribute them among all of those arklets. But there is a plan, Dr. Andrada, for so distributing them, which will be triggered when the BFR breaks through a certain threshold." He nodded.
"Please, call me Miguel."
"Miguel. Moira, if you would."
"Yes. Now, you know why I was chosen to come up here."
"You figured out a way to make photosynthesis in rice more efficient by transplanting genes from maize. Greenpeace destroyed your research facility in the Philippines, but you kept the project alive anyway in Singapore. Starting shortly after zero, you began developing strains of that rice adapted for cultivation in low-G hydroponic environments."
"Sprice,"
Miguel said, with an ever-so-slight roll of the eyes. The term, a contraction of space rice, had been coined by an enthusiastic reporter for the Straits Times and become an unkillable staple of tabloid headlines and internet comment threads.
"Do you understand, Moira, that it cannot grow without some amount of simulated gravity? There has to be an up and a down, or the root system cannot develop. In this, it is more difficult than algae, which doesn't care."
"Oh, we're all going to be eating algae for a long time," Moira said. "Sprice will come later, after we have constructed more environments that rotate to make gravity. And then, Miguel, then..."
"Then what?"
Miguel asked. "Sprue."
"Sprue?"
"Space brew," Moira said. "It's not as good as barley, but you can make beer from rice in a pinch."
"Tap,"
Marcus said. He had to say it because he couldn't do it. The traditional way for a wrestler to tell his training partner that an unbreakable submission hold had been achieved was by tapping him or her on the hand, arm, leg, or whatever could be reached. But Marcus couldn't reach anything. Tekla had both of his arms controlled. She let go of him moments before they drifted into the padded wall of the circus, a large, mostly empty module reserved for exercise, and they raised their hands to absorb the impact. Watching interestedly from the far side of the circus were June Ueda, an engineer named Tom Van Meter, Bowler Erdina, and Vyacheslav Dubsky. The three men were taciturn. Bowler Erdina, who was nothing if not enthusiastic, permitted herself three claps, then stopped when it became clear that no one else was joining in.
"Okay,"
Vyacheslav said.
"Seeing is believing. It is possible to perform sambo in zero gravity."
His eyes flicked in the direction of the others.
"Or jujitsu, or wrestling, or bok, I presume."
"Obviously, there are no throws. None of that shifting of the weight that is so important on the ground,"
Marcus said. June nodded.
"It is a subset, a little bit like ground fighting, but without the ground."
Tom Van Meter, who'd been a collegiate wrestler en route to an engineering degree at Iowa,
turned himself around to face the padded wall, then tried delivering a punch. In spite of his considerable size and strength, it landed weakly and sent him drifting backward across the module.
"We experimented with that, too," Marcus said. "Punches are problematic."
Just before striking the opposite wall, Tom flung both arms outward and slapped the mat to absorb energy.
"If you're in a Taurus or a Bolo, all the usual stuff is going to work," he said. "But you're right. Martial arts in zero-G is a new frontier."
"Once you have come to grapple," Tekla said, "not so different. The Cloud Arc is equipped with a dozen tasers," Marcus said. "I did not request these. They were here when I arrived. No one knows about them. I am not comfortable with having some persons go around with sidearms, even if they are just tasers, while everyone else is unarmed. And yet, we have a population of 2,000 or so. There is no town on Earth of such a population that does not have police. There will be crimes, disputes."
"What does the Constitution say about police?" Bowler Erdina asked. "I haven't read it." All of the others laughed, appreciating her.
"No one has read the bloody thing, Bo. It is this thick when you print it out,"
Marcus said, holding his thumb and index finger 2 inches apart.
"Written by committee, as you would expect."
"To be clear, Marcus," said June, "you are not suggesting..."
"No, June, I am not saying we ignore it. Believe me, I am screaming at these guys every day to make it simpler. To give us the, what do you call it? Cliff notes," Tom said. "Yes, before we fall off the cliff. A simple owner's manual. But somewhere in there, a police force is mentioned. I grepped it. They will have to be citizen police at first, no professionals. I have studied your personnel records. I know that you are all trained in some sort of wrestling. Wrestling is the only form of organized violence that is actually usable aboard a space station, short of absolutely crazy shit."
"How about stick fighting?"
Tom asked.
"I knew you would ask because your CV mentions a little bit of a screamer," Marcus said. "It is a reasonable idea. I have a question, though."
"Yes?"
"Do you see any sticks?"
"Maybe we could grow some trees," Beau suggested.
"That will take a while," Marcus returned. "And so, I am simply asking you this. To spend a little bit of time each day getting together in this module to practice wrestling. It might come in handy."
Dube had slept so poorly, he suspected he hadn't slept at all. But the clock said it was about .15. When he climbed into his sack, it had said .9. He must have dozed off for a while, but he didn't know when. His nightly video conference with Amelia hadn't gone well. It hadn't gone badly. They hadn't raised their voices or come to tears. But at first it had been all about what had just happened in Kuru, and after that, there had been a failure to connect. He'd noticed the same thing with Henry. They were running out of things to say to each other. That was ghastly, but it was true. His family members were all preparing to meet their maker in 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. The government had been handing out free euthanasia pills to anyone who wanted them. Thousands had already swallowed them, and bodies overflowed the morgues. Mass graves were being dug with front-end loaders. Meanwhile, Dube was preparing for, to be blunt, to be honest, the greatest adventure of his life. He wished, at some level, that they were already dead. He had spoken those seemingly unspeakable words to Louisa several days ago, and she had nodded. "Happens all the time," she said. "With caregivers of terminal Alzheimer's patients or similar cases, an enormous sense of shame and guilt comes with it."
But Amelia doesn't have Alzheimer's. She's...
Doesn't matter. Seeing her, talking to her, makes you feel bad. And at some level, your brain wants the thing that makes you feel bad to go away. Simplest reaction in the world. Doesn't make you a bad person. Doesn't mean you have to give in to it. Those thoughts had led to more tossing and turning, if those were the right words for not being able to sleep in a loose sack in zero gravity. As he had wrestled with the question of, when? Predicting it on day 720, plus or minus a few, had been all well and good back on day 360, but day 700 was now approaching its end, and the plus or minus thing was seriously bothering him. Lately, they'd narrowed it down to plus or minus 3 days, but that was in response to political pressure. It wasn't a legit scientific move, and it meant something different to scientists. Laypersons understood it as certainly between 717 and 723. Scientists would instead say that if you could repeat the experiment of blowing up the moon a large number of times and keep track of the time to white sky separately in each case, the numbers would fall into a normal distribution, a bell-shaped curve, with about two-thirds of the instances falling within that range, which meant that the remainder would fall outside of that range, and some would fall well outside of it. It was not out of the question that it could happen tomorrow, that it could be happening right now, while Dube floated in a goddamn sack. So when Dinah came and woke him up just after Dot 15, he wasn't angry at her, more relieved. Basic politeness prevented him from saying so, but she looked a wreck. Not in the sense of being over-the-top emotional, just drained and beat up. "You know about Gianna?" she asked him over her shoulder as they wended their way back to the mining colony.
"Yeah."
"Okay." She said nothing further until they were in her shop. Dube could see the wreckage of old-school communication all over the place. Many sheets of paper taped to the available surfaces, dull pencils drifting around, loose pages from the employee manual with blocks of characters crossed out. "I had to tell Sean to knock it off," she admitted. "I'm used up. Can't do it anymore. Need to get some sleep. This shit is difficult. You have to be precise. Keying slow enough for Sean to copy the transmission is like walking slow."
"Walking slow?"
"You know," Dinah said. "Anyone can walk at a normal pace. That's easy. But when you have to walk at half speed, like because you're accompanying someone who has trouble getting around, it's exhausting."
"Got it."
"When I started to beg off, he changed his topic. To that point, it was all, 'Hey, what's going on? How many people are on the Ark?' But when I applied a little time pressure, he started talking about sensitivity analysis." Dube laughed. "Wow," Dinah said, looking at him keenly. "Not the reaction I expected."
"I've been awake for hours thinking about it,"
Dube said. "So you know what he means? Because I'm just a dumb clodhopper. I had to ask him."
"I assume he means, how certain are we really that it's going to happen on day 720? And just how unstable is the system?"
"Yep, that's what he means."
"The closer we get, the more it's like a nuclear reactor about to go critical, or, well..."
"Pick your metaphor, I get it," Dinah said.
"Anything that's that unstable can be set off by random noise in the system. Things that we inherently cannot predict. Pretty soon it's going to be so on edge that just looking at it funny will set it off. We just don't know which rock is going to trigger the avalanche."
Dinah considered it for a few moments, then broke eye contact and looked at her radio. "Sean does," she said.
"I'm not sure I heard that correctly,"
Dube said, after a long groping pause. "The eight ball," she said. "That's what Sean calls it. It's a rock you don't know about. One you can't see coming.
It's too dark, too far away.
Dinah, I'm confused. Are we talking about a hypothetical asteroid here, or...
No. A specific one. A real one. Look, Dube, you know that Arjuna Expeditions has been putting up CubeSats for years. We have hundreds of eyes in the sky, drifting around taking pictures of near-Earth asteroids, cataloging them, recording their orbital parameters with as much precision as we can manage. Well, apparently he's been lying awake at night, thinking about the same stuff as you. The extreme instability of the debris cloud. Its sensitivity to any kind of perturbation. And he had the bright idea. Why not search through Arjuna's secret database of asteroids to see whether any bad actors were going to be passing through the middle of the lunar debris cloud during the next couple of weeks, when it's on such a hair trigger?
He has that database with him.
Sure, whatever. It's just a spreadsheet.
So he opened that spreadsheet and did that analysis?
Yeah. Dube, listen, I'm piecing this together from circumstantial evidence. You've seen how spotty the communication is.
Understood.
But I think he did that analysis and found an asteroid which he is calling the Eight Ball. I assume it's low albedo.
Black, as eight balls are,
Dube said. I don't know anything about its size or its orbital parameters or any of that. But Sean thinks it's going to pass right through the middle of the cloud in about 6 hours.
6 hours?
And that it has enough kinetic energy to be, well, interesting. Dube was thinking about Amelia, about those emotions that had kept him awake earlier. Predictably, everything had now been reversed, and he was terrified that she and Henry and Hesper and Hadley were all about to die. Dinah misinterpreted this as him making astronomical calculations in his head. "I'm going to go and get 6 hours of sleep," she said. "Good night."
"Good night, Dinah,"
Dube said. It was about dot 16, shift change time, the equivalent of 4 PM for third shifters. So Marcus was approaching the end of what, for any normal earthbound person, would be his workday. Of course, like almost everyone else in the cloud arc, he worked the whole time he was awake. Even his recreational activities, such as martial arts practice in the circus, had a larger purpose. So the afternoon shift change and the end of his workday were purely formal observances. Nevertheless, he was in the habit of using this time of day for dealing with what used to be called paperwork. And as part of that, he had invited to his little private office off of the tank the only lawyer in space, Salvatore Guodian, son of a Singaporean Chinese father and an Italian countess, whose parents had gone to that city-state as tax exiles. He had been educated in a school for mostly British expats, matriculated at Berkeley, dropped out after 1.5 years to join a tech startup, lost his shirt, bummed around to various other startups, finally made some money, become interested in the law, essentially bought his way into law school despite not having a bachelor's degree, worked for 15 years at the Los Angeles, Singapore, Sydney, Beijing, London, and Dubai offices of a white shoe law firm, been passed over for partnership, resigned, ridden his bicycle across China, moved to San Francisco, and become the general counsel of a digital currency trading firm, while in his spare time volunteering for a non-profit cyber rights organization and going out into the desert to launch very large homebrew rockets to the edge of space. Sal, as he was universally known, had been one of the first people chosen to work on the constitution of the Cloud Ark, and so had spent 1.5 years at The Hague before getting yanked, as the expression went, and launched up here. He was 47 years old, but in dim light could have passed for 30. As a way to deal with the exigencies of zero-G life and a surrender to a receding hairline, he had taken to wearing a short vacubuzz. This was the easiest thing to do with hair in space.
The VacuBuzzer was a machine that combined the functions of an electric trimmer and an industrial shop vac. Haircuts were self-serve and consumed about 30 seconds if you were unusually fastidious. Earplugs were recommended. In his halcyon days, Sal had sported a luxuriant head of long, wavy black hair and a widow's peak that brought out his Italian heritage. But with a VacuBuzz, he looked almost purely Chinese. He spoke 7 languages, and he came closer than any living human to having the entire Cloud Arc Constitution, or CAC as he called it, in his brain. If Marcus had anything to say about it, which he did, then Sal would very soon combine in one person the functions of Attorney General, Head Prosecutor, Justice of the Peace, and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Sal laughed. He had great teeth.
You realize that those roles are completely incompatible. They're intended to be one another's mutual adversaries in a lot of ways.
Then you can appoint other people to fill them. Look, Sal, we are talking about a bootstrapping process. They have to start somewhere.
Let's war game it,
Sal said.
Emil Arke, from Outer Bazaaristan, meets a female Arke from Andorra. It happens in a place where we don't have any cameras.
There are very few such places,
Marcus pointed out.
Okay, fine. It happens in an arklet, or so the victim claims. She goes to sickbay, where medical evidence is gathered.
Do we even have rape kits?
Marcus asked.
How should I know?
Sal returned.
But we should get some. Anyway, based on that, in some countries, a judge might issue a warrant enabling the police to look at the video records from that arklet. Because in some countries, Marcus, people have a right to privacy and you can't just be surveilling them all the time.
And what is the situation here?
It's fascinating that you don't even know. But I'll tell you that the CAC recognizes certain rights that, however, may be abrogated or curtailed during periods of simplified administrative procedures and structures.
PSAPs,
Marcus said.
That I know about. It is a euphemism for martial law.
Sal looked somewhere between pained and amused.
May I suggest you stop thinking about it that way, or, failing that, never say it out loud.
But, nevertheless,
a better analogy might be the authority a captain wields over a ship at sea. The captain can do things like preside over marriage ceremonies or order someone confined to quarters that would not be acceptable if the same ship were tied up to a pier in Manhattan.
Look, I do not have time now to wargame a whole prosecution of a hypothetical rape,
Marcus said, glancing at his wristwatch. Swiss, naturally, and made specifically for him by a famous Geneva company, as a sort of legacy, a way of saying, we existed once, and here is what magnificent things we were capable of.
I want to talk about something very basic, very fundamental, which is, how do I have authority? Or, if I am replaced by Ivy or Ulrika, how does she have authority?
Sal didn't quite see where he was going.
Authority meaning?
When this elicited no response other than impatient muttering, Sal tried,
authority can mean many different things, Marcus.
In this case, I am not speaking of moral authority or leadership qualities or any of that stuff. I do not mean the theoretical loyalty that Arkis have to the so-called captain of the ship. I mean, what happens if we go to arrest the rapist from Outer Bazaaristan and he decides to put up a fight, and his friends decide that they are going to fight with him?
Sal, to this point, had been viewing the conversation as an enjoyable exercise in legal theory. He now looked more serious.
You're talking about power, what it really means, what it really is.
Yes.
It's an old question. A pharaoh, a medieval king, the mayor of New York City, they all have to think about the same thing.
Yes,
Marcus said again.
When you give an order, what assurance do you have that it will be carried out? That is the essential question of power.
Yavol, Counselor.
Normally, here I would speak to you about moral authority and loyalty and all of that, but you have already ruled this out.
When push comes to shove, as the English expression has it,
the traditional answer has always been that the king has his guard, the mayor his chief of police, the commander his military police or what have you, and it is their ability to physically coerce others that is the ultimate foundation of the leader's power.
Now you're talking. And what is that for me, under the CAC?
You understand, Sal said, that the more you actually call upon such persons to coerce, the less power you have, in a way. It is an admission of failure.
Sal, Marcus said, how long have you been up here?
200 and some days.
How many hours have we spent talking about the CAC?
I have no idea. Probably 100 hours over that time.
And of that, how much time have we spent talking about this one thing?
Sal checked his own watch. Maybe 15 minutes.
So, based on that allocation of time, Marcus said, maybe you can see that this is not all that important to me in the big scheme of things. But it is important, Sal. When the moment comes when I have to arrest a criminal who is being protected by his comrades, I must have an answer. I must know what to do. I must be prepared. This is what I do. This is why I have this job.
Someone was knocking on the door to Marcus's office, which was unusual. Marcus ignored it for now.
Under PSAPs, you can deputize specific people to enforce your decisions using appropriate levels of physical coercion. Once we get out of PSAPs...
How soon do you think that is going to happen?
Marcus's tone of voice suggested that he had his own opinions on the matter.
If we are lucky enough to survive, it will be years,
Sal said.
So... We must confine ourselves to PSAPs for this discussion, Marcus said.
Then he hollered at the door.
Just a minute!
Then back to Sal.
Appropriate levels of physical coercion. What does that mean? Who decides?
Well, Sal said, if you make me Attorney General, head prosecutor, Justice of the Peace, and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, I guess I do.
If someone gets tased and his heart stops and he dies, is that appropriate?
Jesus Christ, Marcus. What has gotten into you?
I am wargaming, Marcus said, trying to be prepared. You should do it too, not with hypothetical rape cases, but with what is likely to start happening soon.
He held Sal's gaze until Sal answered with a nod. Then he aimed his voice at the door.
All right, come in.
Door was a landlubber term for what, on a boat or a spaceship, would be called a hatch. A convention had developed where, in a part of Izzy that had simulated gravity, it was referred to as a door. In the floaty bits, it was called a hatch. The door opened to reveal Dubois Jerome Xavier Harris. The look on his face... combined with the mere fact that he had interrupted Marcus during a meeting in his private office, suggested that something serious was happening. Marcus's mind jumped straight to the most obvious explanation.
Is the president nuking people again?
Dr. Harris looked startled by the suggestion, then shook it off. No, it wasn't that.
Does this meeting require privacy?
Marcus asked, with a look at Sal. Sal stood, volunteering to make himself scarce. But Dr. Harris just got a bemused look.
It concerns the least private thing that ever happened, or ever will,
he said.
So no thank you. I have reason to believe that the timetable has just been pushed up very significantly. There is a chance that the white sky could happen as soon as 6 hours from now.
He checked his watch.
Call it 5.
Marcus's eye flicked to a display on the wall.
I see no uptick in the BFR.
It will be triggered by the passage of an asteroid through the cloud.
Does anyone on the ground know?
It depends on to what extent this office is under surveillance.
So, your information does not come from the ground?
No. It comes from deep space.
Via encrypted Morse code?
Marcus inquired casually. He and Sal exchanged a look. Their conversation had begun an hour ago with reading a memo from JBF complaining about such transmissions and demanding that action be taken. It was in discussing how to take such action and whether the White House had any authority in the matter that Marcus and Sal had wandered into their more general discussion of power, which was how Marcus liked it, for now. Because if someone was sending mysterious encrypted Morse code transmissions from Izzy, it had to be his girlfriend. And he wasn't going to arrest her. People would howl about conflict of interest. People who would be dead soon. People who had no way to enforce their authority here. Unless they had planted, among the Arkies or the general population, fifth columnists with orders to execute a coup d'etat if necessary.
Marcus,
Dr. Harris asked,
are you hearing me? Do you understand what I just said?
I beg your pardon, Dr. Harris. I just got distracted thinking about the kind of things that Sal is supposed to think about.
Feel free to delegate some of that, Sal said. I know it's not your strong suit, but...
Close the door, please, Marcus said.
Dr. Harris did.
I am reasonably sure of no surveillance in here.
Noted.
It is Dinah, isn't it, Dube?
Marcus asked. Dube nodded.
She's talking to Sean Probst over an encrypted channel.
Marcus shook his head admiringly.
What a girl. My God, she is trouble.
Dube and Sal were silent. During their silence, Marcus thumbed out a one-word text message to Tekla.
Sal,
Marcus said,
I declare peace ups.
I don't think we are yet authorized to...
Who is going to stop us?
Dube and Sal again were silent on the matter.
Is Julia, I do not call her the president anymore, going to nuke us?
He was continuing to thumb out messages as he talked.
She, or the Russians, or the Chinese, might have other ways of removing you from your position.
I have thought about this, Marcus said, about the possibility that there are plants. Military guys with tasers or whatever, waiting for such an order. I have talked to Fyodor, to Sheng, to Zeke, trying to sound them out, to get a feel for it.
Marcus,
Dube said,
with respect, I don't think... that this is what you ought to be focusing on right now.
Which is why I am delegating the constitutional side of it to Sal and the operational side of it to her.
Marcus nodded toward the door, which had swung open without a knock. Tekla glided through and closed it behind her.
We don't have to announce to the whole world that we are going to peace apps. We have 5 hours in which to begin preparations quietly. I will contact Moira and tell her that we must begin preparations to disperse the genetic samples to the Arklets. I will tell Ulrika that we must pull the trigger on the search.
By this, Marcus meant a long-planned burst of launches that was supposed to happen in the few days' grace period between the white sky and the onset of the hard rain.
We can be working on these things quietly. 5 hours from now, it will happen or it will not. If it does not, we go back to as we were and consider this a dress rehearsal.
The door opened again, this time after a knock, and in came a young man named Steve Lake, preceded by his laptop and followed by his dreadlocks. For Steve, in his year and a half aboard Izzy, had not succumbed to the vacu-buzzer's siren song, but he had gotten tired of messing with his long hair and had allowed it to congeal into red ropes. Formerly employed by a consulting firm in Northern Virginia that hired hackers to do secret work for intelligence agencies, he had been yanked and sent up to support Spencer Grindstaff, the networks and communications specialist who'd been one of Izzy's original crew on Zero. Spencer was an NSA man through and through, recruited straight out of MIT to work on spooky crypto stuff. Steve seemed to be an altogether different sort of character. He looked a bit mystified just now.
"Steve," Marcus said, "it is time for us to have a conversation about power."
Steve's brow furrowed.
"You mean electrical power or
the other kind?"
"Okay. And is this going to be like an abstract philosophical discussion or
no? It is going to conclude with me telling you, under my PSAP's authority, to change all of the passwords and keys for Izzy's control systems."
"Wow," Steve said. "Shouldn't you be talking to Spencer then? Because he's above me in the org chart."
"I am familiar with the org chart," Marcus said. "Under PSAPs, I have the authority to change it."
"What is this PSAPs thing you keep talking about, Marcus?"
"Sal will explain it later. For now, we may set it aside. Fundamentally, we speak of your loyalty, your allegiance. I think that Spencer is extremely loyal to powers that be on the ground. I do not wish to put him in an impossible bind. He will later come with us, or he will not. You, I believe, to be a different kind of fellow. I ask you, in effect, to now become loyal to the Cloud Ark and the Cloud Ark alone. Not to Washington, not to Houston, and to accept the authority of whoever is the boss of the Cloud Ark, which for now is me."
"Okay."
"You're supposed to think about it first, Steve. Not just say okay."
"I've been thinking about it for a while, but I have to tell you, there might be back doors. I can change all the codes I know about. The ones I don't know about are a different matter."
"Then we shall just have to be vigilant."
White sky. Dube couldn't guess how many times during his life he had noted a cottony tuft of cloud in a blue sky, then looked up hours later to discover that it had developed into a bank of clouds that covered the sun and told of a change in the weather. Such phenomena happened too slowly for the mind to discern them as happening at all. During the last hours of A+1.335, something like that occurred in the cloud of lunar debris that had been hanging in the sky for the last 700 days. Later they would watch the movies of it in time-lapse, compressing a day's changes into a minute of video, and it would look like an explosion. Or an epidemic of explosions. If you watched the video carefully enough, frame by frame, you could see it progress from one part of the cloud to the next as the eight ball shot through. Like a particle lancing through a cloud chamber, it was invisible save for the trail of consequences it left in its wake. A few months earlier, it might have passed through without touching anything. But today, the density of rocks in the cloud was such that it could not avoid smashing into some of them on its way through. Dube, making a crude statistical calculation, put the likely number of collisions at 10, plus or minus 5. Not a large number in a cloud that now contained millions of rocks, but enough to push the system, trembling on the precipice of an exponential explosion over the edge. Around its unseen track, the white sky took form and fury. The cloud bloomed and evoluted like cream and coffee, spreading and paling, though from place to place one could see fresh bursts as rocks hurled out of earlier collisions found distant targets and touched off smaller chain reactions of their own. In places, it took on a cellular structure as curved detonation fronts spread, contacted others, and merged into lacy foams of white arcs. It had an austere, monochromatic beauty about it. There was no fire and no light other than what cold sunlight the rocks bounced back to the eye. Later, when they began to enter the atmosphere, there would be fire and plenty of it. But for now, the world was ending in a fractal blooming of dust and gravel, an apocalypse in a gravel quarry.
"You pretty much nailed it,"
someone told Dube.
when you called it the white sky.
Being right does not always bring satisfaction, he said.
The bolide fragmentation rate shot up through all meaningful thresholds within a few hours of the eight ball's arrival, and Dube stopped paying attention to it. The number was probably wrong now. It was just an estimate, produced by a consortium of observatories based on the amount and distribution of light coming out of the cloud. All the assumptions that went into its calculation had now become obsolete. He tried aiming his optical telescope at where PP1 and PP2 and Cleft, the large, metal-rich children of Peach Pit, ought to be, but saw nothing except, possibly, some local highlights in the density of the cloud, perhaps caused by rocks dashing themselves to pieces on the steely surfaces of those dark bolides. He wondered if he would ever see them again. He no longer had an accurate visual memory of the size of the moon in the sky, and so he could not estimate how many times larger the cloud was. Of course, he could look those numbers up and calculate it, but he didn't really care what the numbers said. The full moon had always been the same size, but sometimes it looked huge and sometimes it looked small, depending on how close it was to the horizon, and on factors that were purely psychological or aesthetic. To all but a few of the people on the night side of Earth, looking up at the cloud, those factors were the only ones that mattered. He wanted to know how big it looked to them. He wanted to know how it felt. He wanted to see it over the Chino Hills from the courtyard of the Caltech Athenium, which was where he had last seen the moon, a few minutes before zero, and to know how it was to stand there on terra firma and to see it and to know it was death coming. Like most people, he had drawn up a list of everyone in the world he needed to say goodbye to, then gone through it and ruthlessly weeded out 90% of the names, since there wasn't time. And then, during his last few months on Earth, he had sought out and said goodbye to the ones he needed to see in person. From orbit, he had said goodbye to others on video conferencing links or with carefully written email messages. Once he had said goodbye to a given person, he avoided communicating with them again. It was awkward to go out for a last night of drinking with a colleague, reminisce and cry and hug and say farewell, and then find yourself emailing the same person 2 months later with a question about their latest observations. Consequently, his scope of acquaintances had steadily narrowed as he had worked his way down the list. By this point, he was down to his wife and his children. Reaching them became a lot more difficult after the eight ball had done its work. The volume of communications between Izzy and the ground was limited by the total bandwidth of the station's antennas and radios. Personal communications had lower priority than operations, and operations were peaking as the final surge of launches was prepared, or, as Dinah called it, the splurge. Dube sent text messages to Amelia and the kids all the time. They sat in the delivery queue for minutes or hours, and half of them never got sent at all. Just when he was about to give up hope, he'd get a message back from Henry or Hadley or Hesper. Sending those messages and seeing the responses became more important than sleeping. So he broke shift, as the saying went, and dozed whenever he could, lying on the floor of the farm or just putting his head down on a table like a kindergarten kid, his phone right next to his face so he'd feel it jump when anything came through. It finally became clear to him, maybe 24 hours after he had given the news about the eight ball to Marcus, that he was never going to communicate with his loved ones again, save through sporadic and unpredictable texts. Anything he needed to say to them directly, he ought to have said before, which should not have come as news. He had been telling himself for a long time that you had to act as if each conversation might be the last. This did not stop him from reviewing his final video chats with each one of them on the evening of day 700 and wishing he'd said certain things.
How does it look from up there?
Henry texted him. Dube checked the time. It was night in Moses Lake. He imagined Henry sitting out on that crappy old couch that they'd moved out of the house in Seattle, drinking a beer between work shifts, watching the white sky reach out for him like a spectral hand. Dube didn't know what to say.
I think I'm seeing some spread along the orbital axis. The beginning of rings.
He texted back. I meant Earth. Henry returned. Dube went looking for a place where he could look down at Earth through a real window. Not one of those damned situational awareness monitors. This ended up being the woo-woo pod. It was pretty crowded. Izzy was about to swing over the Terminator from day into night. Even over the brightly lit Pacific, they could see what looked like hairline scratches in the pellucid shell of the atmosphere. The white trails left by incoming bolides.